I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
You're listening to Farming News with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Irish Farmers Journal podcast. It's New Year's Eve. We're all looking forward to 2022. But first, we're going to take a quick look back at 2021, the highs and lows, the talking points, and I suppose the big things that affected agriculture globally and in Ireland this year. I'm joined in studio by a veritable plethora of experts. I've got editor Justin McCarthy. I have dairy editor Aidan Brennan, our calf guru Darren Carthy, ICL editor Amy McKeever, and for those who are outside the building, obviously that's Irish Country Living, and Pat O'Toole, political correspondent. Justin, if I can go to you first, I suppose it's been the second full year, almost full year of COVID. We've had a lot of political moves. We've had, you know, implementation of the Green Deal. There's been an awful lot to affect agriculture from the outside in the last year. Any of those, you know, I suppose there's been highs and lows. What were the standout ones for you?
I suppose, Katrina, it's been a year of BCC, Brexit, COVID and climate and really what you're looking at is agriculture has become much, much more exposed to global policies and trends. And we're seeing that very clearly. We're seeing it in a positive way, actually, at the minute in relation to global commodity prices. And there's no doubt when we look at record sheep prices, strong dairy prices, strong beef prices and strong grain prices currently and both into the futures market as well. We're benefiting from that. But I suppose the warning there, it does show that a lot of this is cyclical and what goes up can come down and we can, I suppose, be very exposed to political decisions. And certainly around climate change, there's a lot of that happening at the minute in terms of we're seeing evidence of that coming down the tracks. And I think really what 2021 was, it put the train on the track in relation to a lot of this political stuff. And it maybe hasn't arrived yet at farm gate level, but unfortunately it is coming. And a lot of that is driven by climate change and climate change policies. We saw in COP 26 in Glasgow a lot of commitments, a lot of pledges being made around climate change. And a lot of those really farming being centre stage in that. And I think certainly when you look at what I envisage coming down the tracks will be major changes in global land use policy, certainly around afforestation, rewetting, biodiversity, which will fundamentally, and also renewables actually, which will fundamentally shift food production across the current agricultural land base. Then you're also looking at higher energy prices, and farmers will be well aware of that in relation to the price of nitrogen, as I think Aidan and Darren had in the paper just before Christmas there, farmers paying up to 900 euros a tonne now for urea. A lot of that is driven effectively from natural gas going from 20 euros a megawatt hour to 120 euros a megawatt hour as countries look to transition their energy industry. And then, of course, you have CAP And you can see that the whole climate element very, very much shaped around the cap. Money going away, I suppose, effectively from food security into environmental dividend. And I suppose all those trains have left the station in 2021. Some of them will be coming into Farmers Vision in 2022 and more in 2023 when we have the new cap. So really, it was a year of policy. I think, Katrina, you mentioned highs. One high I would say is I think there is a growing realization that farming is up for this challenge of climate change and actually can be part of the solution rather than being always painted as a problem, whether it be through carbon sequestration, biodiversity loss, and the important role that Irish agriculture actually will play in reducing the overall carbon footprint of feeding the world.
One criticism during the year, Justin, this year, and I would have said maybe a bit last year as well, is that at a European level, the agricultural commissioner has been maybe not as strong as previous commissioners. I know we had an Irish one, but even before that, that the lead has been taken in some initiatives by other commissioners.
We have a non-existent.
For example, on the health side of things.
Yeah, we have a non-existent agricultural commissioner, Katrina. I was just looking back. I think if you compare the number of times we would have mentioned Commissioner Hogan in the paper when he was agricultural commissioner, say back in 2019, to the number of times we've mentioned the existing commissioner, there would be no comparison. There is no doubt agricultural policy is being set by an environmental and a health agenda. I would say probably primarily by an environmental agenda. But to be honest with you, Katrina, we see very similar trends here in Ireland, that whilst Minister McConnell, I think, has done a very good job engaging with farmers and going round, but ultimately there is a real challenge there as to who is setting the agricultural policy now, and certainly we have seen a much more environmental focus and the Department of Environment playing a much bigger role certainly in this CAP than would have been seen before, and there's maybe more evidence of a green thread through agricultural policy today than there would have been in the past. But to be honest with you, Katrina, that's not necessarily a bad thing, provided it maintains an intense focus on economic sustainability at farm level.
Has it done that so far, though, do you think?
There's very little evidence of it, Katrina. Yeah. And what really frustrates me is policy being developed and driven, and some seismic policy changes, particularly around organics. Certainly farmers aren't addicted to nitrogen, and certainly not at 900 euros a tonne. The reason farmers use nitrogen in conventional farming is because it's the most efficient way of producing food. Organics, no problem with organics, but just show me the markets for it and show me the economic viability of converting so much of our agricultural land into organic production. And if farmers can see that that's going to be more profitable for them, well, that's fantastic. But we haven't seen that yet, and we're being required to take a huge leap of faith into the unknown. Like at the end of the day, you're dealing with family farm incomes here, and I think it deserves much more rigorous scrutiny than a lot of the policy measures are getting at the minute.
Yeah, and I suppose at a home level as well, we've seen a quadrupling, I think it is, of funding for the organic sector. Amy, in Irish Country Living, that's something that you've looked at, I suppose, organic farming in general, but food producers, and there's that threat of food inflation, quite a significant threat of food inflation. What are you hearing, or what have you heard this year from food producers on that front?
So we covered off when this new scheme was introduced, and there was difficulty and, you know, with different areas of agriculture getting prioritised for the organic scheme, which, you know, a lot of, let's say, meat, beef and lamb farmers that are in organics already are selling their meat commercially, because unfortunately, despite the drive towards it, we haven't seen at consumer level a real desire to pay extra for this. So recent information that's come out from Bourbea has indicated that 50% of people are willing to pay 10% more, and not any more than that. They'll pay 10% more for organics, but they won't pay 15% more. Now, the Irish market has increased for organic produce by nearly 18% in 2020, which is €235 million. It's still a very small proportion. And I suppose there's a couple of difficulties with it. One is that, you know, is the cart before the horse in terms of if we put this product on the shelf, are people going to buy it? Which, you know, it doesn't look like they're going to want to pay more for it. And if you ask a consumer what they want, they will say, I want this, I want that, I want high welfare, I want organic, I want fair trade. But then when it actually comes to filling that shopping basket and trying to feed a family, those, the monetary element of this does very much come into it. And I suppose I would be concerned, like, you know what I mean? Like James Flavin, and we did our 50 kilometer diet. We were trying to source food within 50 kilometers to see how easy it is to shop local. And what we found was that, you know, the level of convenience that people are provided with now in terms of sourcing their food by able to go into one supermarket and buy whatever they want is, you know, it makes it incredibly difficult then to have to go and move around from shop to shop in the way that traditionally people would have shopped, you know, 30, 40 years ago. But I would say that, like, in terms of organics, if you take a year or a year and a half ago, Flavins couldn't source enough organic oats for their porridge. And now they don't want any more suppliers. They have enough and they can even export. And I think that's, you know, there is a desire amongst people to buy organic food, but not all people. And we just need to be careful that the value of organic for the people that can afford to pay for it and pay that extra isn't lost, because it becomes the bottom level. And this has always been a concern, that every time you add a value claim to a product, you're ultimately saying that the other product is not as good. And then, so it's very important that in the food chain, that the fact that this is a more difficult product to produce, it's expensive, the yield is lower, that needs to be reflected in the price. But I think a lot of this as well comes back down to consumer perception of agriculture, and it feeds into what Justin is talking about there. Traditionally in Ireland, we have always had a very strong relationship between the consumer and the farmer. You know, farmers' protests were always supported by the general public. The CAP was always supported because people understood that this was, providing a very safe level of safe and traceable food for people at a price they could afford. And I think that this year has definitely seen that perception start, you know, to come under a lot of pressure. Because people don't understand where their food is coming from as much anymore. Like, AgriWare did a recent survey. They do this kind of pulse poll every couple of years to see where public perception is. And the big thing that came out of that was this feeling that, you know, school kids, only 11% of school kids know where their food is coming from. 16% of adults. This is like, you know, we might think in the Farmers Journal bubble that everybody is linked to a farm, but that's getting less and less the case now in Ireland, and it is a big concern. We do need to continue to educate people about the quality food that we're producing to maintain that positive public perception towards our agriculture in Ireland.
Katrina, if I could just come in there, I think what Amy says, it really needs a debate at European level, because food production is a global business. It's not European, it's not Irish, and we do need to be conscious of the demands that's going to come in food production across the world. And it's very easy for a region like Europe or even in Ireland to talk about higher food prices and whatnot. But there's large cohorts of society across the world trying to get their calorific intake consumed within $1 to $2 a day. And we need to have a very serious conversation here in Europe about global food security, about food security within Europe, but also about, and food security is not just about availability, food security is about being able to afford it as well. And what nobody is talking about, and no politician is having an honest conversation with consumers yet, it's all talking about what farmers need to do. But where the average person in Europe spends as much on, half as much on packaged holidays a year as they do on food, there's something fundamentally wrong there. And there needs to be a very serious discussion around food prices as well. And when you see most people in developed countries spending less than 10% of their household income now on food, the price of food needs to and the price of sustainability and the price of all of these things that Amy talks about needs to be factored into the debate, and so really food prices need to come front and center as well.
Yeah, and I would personally find it quite worrying that 10% is the most, seems to be the ceiling for the extra that they will pay for organic, because 10%, I'd say, is at the bottom end of the reduction in output from a farm if it was to turn organic.
But see, Katrina, there's a fundamental problem. Nobody actually knows the answer to that question because the economic modelling hasn't been done. I'd love somebody to tell me, here's what the market can deliver and here's what a farmer will need to improve his financial bottom line. Everybody talks about this new era and this new green opportunity, but nobody has put figures on it. And I think if it's not going to be from politicians, I think farm organisations should actually be coming forward with this economic modelling done to actually inform the debate with the facts on this.
Amy, yourself and myself were talking about this the other day. There is an interesting move within the Department of Agriculture, which I think will probably increase the prominence of the organic sector, and shows a little bit of the weight. They've moved a well-known department head to the organic unit.
So Jack Nolan's been moved from nitrates into, and I think Jack would be very familiar to a lot of farmers because he's been so involved in nitrates over the last number of years. And I think that does really demonstrate that the department wants to give this a lot of support. What I'd really like to see is what Justin just spoke about there, and that Jack would put some numbers on this, on what kind of a model is going to be profitable for farmers. Like, we have a series running at the moment, which Janine is writing, called In Conversion, which we're following some organic farmers, from farmers that are converting from organics, and looking at the economics of it, when they start to hit a profit, how they find the promotion, what supports they're getting from government or from Bord Bia or from wherever they can get it. But it is actually very difficult in terms of actually getting numbers about when this starts to work. And as I'll go back to what I said as well, that if you can get a premium in the market at the moment, that's great. But if there's a huge quantity, if there's an oversupply of organic products relative to what the consumer wants, that product will get discounted. And that is what happens in the food chain. And then your organic producers who went down this line for an added value element won't be able to get that added value anymore. And, there is a good, they've taken a good bit of money and put it into this organic scheme under the new cap. And we'll just have to see how that support transpires into or turns into actual profitability for farmers. I think as well, let's say if you get, as I said at the start, a lot of beef and lamb is sold, that's organic, is sold as conventional. To be fair, a lot of beef and lamb farmers are not that far off organic as it is in their normal systems in this country. I understand that milk is paid for on a flat basis. So when you work out your solids versus the price that you can get paid for organic milk, like, I think farmers really need to sit down and think about doing the numbers on this before they'd move into a conversion. And as I said, we're following a couple of farmers to see how they fare with that.
And that's continuing?
Yeah, that's continuing, yeah.
Great. Thanks, Amy. Aidan, I suppose output might be restricted has been certainly the talking point for the latter half of 2021 is fertiliser price and availability. That will certainly have an impact on Irish farms, dairy probably being the highest grassland user of fertiliser. Have farmers adjusted already to paying this huge amount, 900 euro a tonne for urea, and do you see it continuing?
Well, I think it takes a fair mental adjustment to get used to 900 euros a tonne for urea, Katrina. And to be fair, most farmers probably aren't in that space yet because a lot of them wouldn't buy fertiliser until next February or March. It's those that probably want to have it in the yard beforehand and are probably more aware of what's happening in the marketplace and the restrictions in not only, in supply, which is quite leading to the high prices. They want the fertiliser in the yard, so they're in that space yet at the moment. But for the majority of farmers, they're probably not there yet. But it has big implications. It has big implications for, number one, for profits next year. Travelers are forecasting a 22% drop in profits for 2022 compared to 2021, on the back of higher input costs. But also the implications they're going to have in terms of the fodder supply and maybe the knock-on effect for foods, for people, because this is a global issue. The high prices aren't seen really in the US as much as they are in Europe and Russia and places like that, but it's going to spread everywhere and it's going to have knock-on implications.
And Aidan, looking back at the year, I suppose, as a whole, what have been the highs or lows or the talking points of the year for dairy farmers, but livestock farmers in general? I suppose it's not strictly restricted to dairy farmers.
Yeah, sure. Look, I suppose most farmers will look at 2021 in two lights. On the one hand, it's been a really good year for product prices. So dairy in particular and beef and lamb in particular as well, and even the silage sector, really strong prices for products. So that's, dairy incomes are up 30% this year compared to 30% in 2021 compared to 2020. It's really strong year for core farming principles. And weather was pretty benign. Okay, it was a cold April and May, and that reduced grass growth in the spring. But the back end was super then as well. We grew, I think, as a country, we grew more grass in September than we did in May. Now overall grass growth is back about 3%. But like, you know, the core principles of good weather and good prices, like 2021 is a really good year for those things. So we can't fault it. But on the policy front, you know, farmers really got hit badly this year, I suppose, you have to say, in terms of nitrates, climate action plan, changes the cap, and Darren's going to talk about that. But on the dairy front end, you have had Gambia implementing new peat milk restrictions, and all that has to do with the environment and environmental restrictions and new environmental regulations. And I suppose many farmers felt that they were, you know, in the crosshairs of all that.
In something that I've come across, and I will admit it's mainly on social media, but, you know, this idea that some farmers see the number of restrictions coming on them as enough to almost step away from the cap subsidies. Is that a total red herring?
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that being a runner, really. I mean, like, the majority of the restrictions in terms of cap are related to good agricultural practice, and that, you know, farmers have no more than doctors have, you know, that their objectives to not to do harm. You know, farmers don't want to do harm to the environment either. So I don't see many farmers walking away from single farm payment or BPS, whatever the new name of it is going to be. Just because, like for most farmers, it's a vital part of their income. They won't be able to afford to do so. Even the dairy farmers that you say are, you know, the most profitable, a lot of them rely to a large degree on the subsidies coming in October and December to bolster income, pay wages and pay leases.
I think, yeah. Katrina, it's not only a red herring, it's an extremely dangerous narrative as well, because at the end of the day, all businesses are regulated. Agriculture is regulated, but gets a support through CAP for doing it. You move away from that and you look at the pig sector, where do you move to? You move to an EPA license. So I would be very, very cautious at creating that narrative among farmers, because I think the consequences of it are not, is further regulation and maybe not the same levels of support. And so I'd urge a bit of caution on that front.
Yeah, no, I think it is a bit of a pie in the sky idea myself, but it's still something that gets thrown out every now and then, because there have been a lot of restrictions applied or proposed this year, and some of them would be graded. The nitrates that Aidan is talking about is going out from here to 2024 by the time all of them are fully implemented. I'm going to go to Darren now, because Darren, you know, the new cap has been, we've been writing about it every week this year. It's fundamental to farmers' income, and there is a fundamental change in it.
Yeah, definitely, Katrina. Justin talked at the outset about change in global policies around food production and around food scarcities in the future and that. And like, there was one, in the first consultation document that was released, there was one sort of phrase that stuck out to me, and there was green architecture, to something I'd never heard of before. I'd even looked to see what it was, and it was pretty much showing the future direction of the CAP, or where, I suppose, the department or the EU see it going. And really, it's another further step away from supporting primary producers or supporting, say, food production. I think Minister McConnell said even a few times that this was, I suppose, a shift to safeguard and environmental policy at the sort of forefront of environmental good. And that's all well and good, pardon the pun, but it is another step away from, say, primary food producers. And if we look at, say, the CAP as a whole, like, we're now, I suppose, maybe over 20 years since it's relevant to what farmers actually did, that we're sort of still basing payments on a really historic, I suppose, level of production at this case. But it's nearly becoming irrelevant, because we're now going to, I suppose, maybe supporting or rewarding farmers around what they're going to do for the environment in the future. And if we just look at a couple of figures, like last time out, the CAP, there was, I suppose, maybe an appetite, or there was maybe a move towards the environment too, what was called greening. And if you looked at, say, the payment process, there was 56% of the money was on, say, supporting farmers. Greening was 44% of, say, the entitlement values. But really, everybody got greening. 99.999% of people got the greening payment. This time it's going to be a lot different, in that there's a lot more hoops to jump through, that even one figure like 25% of every farmer's entitlement value has been taken out to fund eco schemes or a suite of sort of environmental good measures. That's amounting to close to 300 million a year, which is major money, and has been quite divisive because I suppose, look, that's money farmers would have got before. They have a chance of getting some of that money now, depending on your entitlement value and depending on the level of participation. And look, we can, if you want to come back to it, we can talk about, say, that at least there has been movement to get, say, to find a workable scheme for farmers. But there's a lot of other elements of the CAP that is going to see, I suppose, maybe productive farmers, farmers that are really reliant on CAP payments, and they are going to have their payments very much eroded. Like if we look at, say, Chris, or what's commonly known as front load, you're going to see 10% of every entitlement value taken from a farmer, and they have a chance to get some of that back depending on what area they are. So up to 30 hectares will probably be in a position to get a lot of the money back for maybe 70% of farmers. People on high value entitlements will lose there. And then people on high value entitlements are going to lose to, say, the BIS or the new basic payment scheme payment. And that to me is probably going to make full-time enterprises more vulnerable. It's going to make even part-time systems that have high value entitlements that are really reliant on that. It's going to change the whole dynamics around that. And I can see in a few years' time that after this CAP is finishing, that you're going to have a significantly different environment for farming in this. If you're going to keep continuing to erode payments to farmers that need it most, well, then you're going to make them systems more and more vulnerable. But I suppose, look, to talk about where we finish up the year is that we now have a plan that is going to be submitted to Brussels by the 31st of December. That has to be approved by Brussels. We have seen, I suppose, maybe the final, you could say, draft on it in this consultation phase ended on the 8th of December. I don't think there's going to be any change much to what we have seen there. Like one of, I suppose, maybe the things in this is that Minister of Agriculture, Charlie McConlogue, has been, I suppose, maybe he's been open to listen to suggestions. He's been open to going out and meeting farmers. But you could very much say that he's kept firm in his plan, and he hasn't allowed the myriad of, I suppose, demands from farm organisations to sway what he feels is the best outcome going forward. And because of that, I don't see many changes. We opened a document that's gone to Brussels. I'd say that we're looking at continuing to be eco schemes at 25%, CRIS at 10%, Convergence 85%. Young farmers funding at 3%, National Reserve at 3%. I think that you're going to have all of that continuing as is. If I may finish on this one, the big unknown, and I suppose, look, we have seen, we've talked about CAP all year long. We've started the year talking about it. We'll finish the year probably writing about the document being submitted to the EU. But the big elephant in the room is what's going to happen around entitlement leasing, sales of entitlements, and that has just created an absolute, I don't know what way to describe it in the last few weeks, confusion upon confusion upon confusion, in that farmers don't know, say that they're in long-term leases, what way it's going to affect them. The department put out that there will be a program, say, of different clawback systems or proposals on that. And all of that uncertainty, to me, that is, if we can get one thing sorted in January, and even preferably the start of the January, is we need to get clarity around entitlement leasing, entitlement sales, because that to me is going to be the greatest challenge for on the policy side for the first part of 2022.
I think, Darren, the phrase that I've certainly used about the entitlements issue is can open worms everywhere, because there are so many problems and issues and legal, like there's potentially a lot of work in this for solicitors in the new year, but we'll leave them to
Katrina, if I could just come in with a real life example of what Darren is talking about. I met with a group of farmers recently, and one farmer put all his figures on the table. He's claiming about 100,000 in single farm payment, and that sounds like a considerable lot of money, and it is. Of that, only about 28,000 of it is his own entitlements, and he has 11 different lease agreements with different farmers across the country that he is claiming the entitlements and passing them back. Now, you take what Darren is saying there under the current. That guy is in long-term land leases with these guys. He is farming their land, he's claiming their entitlements, and he's sending it back to them. He will automatically get hit by the capping, so half of his entitlements will more or less go. He will then only get one CRSP payment, so 10% of that will disappear, and he'll get his 30 hectares back. And because he has a big payment, there'll be a lot of people having very little sympathy, but what actually lands up back in his business is actually all his own entitlements, which is about 25,000. So how does he go back to those landlords now and tell them that half their entitlements are gone, or what way does he operate? It is just going to be an absolute, a real difficult position. And unfortunately, there's no clarity coming forward on it at all.
And it's not only a handful of farmers that are affected at all levels, whether they're leasing in or leasing out. I think it's 30,000 farmers, Darren, in total are involved in the leasing of entitlements. Pat, you're going to come in there for us. You've looked at this in detail as well. Tillage farmers would be one of the groups that would be quite involved in leasing.
Absolutely. A lot come down to the way the lease is written. If the lease has a value attached to the entitlement, or says a value attached to the lease in terms of euros per hectare, you're legally bound, bar you break the lease or bar you claim just force majeure. Some farmers would have anticipated potential changes, and what they have written is that it's X euros per hectare for the land plus the value of the entitlement, and the value of the entitlement will not have the CRIS, because the CRIS is obviously conditional, and the value of the entitlement will not have the eco schemes money, because you don't need entitlements to claim eco schemes money, and we know that. It'll be back, it'll be the basic income unit for support sustainability, which will be 40% less than this year's payment, greening included. And in terms of landowners, it's very hard to have sympathy for people who have continually leased out the entitlements and gained the full value of them, because that's an abuse of the system as it was originally intended, which has been facilitated by the department for 20 years. But the broader issue is that we now have a situation where the management of entitlements and the government policy around entitlements is running in direct opposite direction to the taxation incentives around land mobility, which give all the advantages to the landowner. So if you're a landowner, you're leasing out your land tax-free. If the entitlements are leased out with the land, that's tax-free. And that can run into an awful lot of money. But now the department are saying that they're going to put clawbacks on short-term leases. They're going to encourage long-term leases. And they're going to reduce the clawback for 2 years on the sale of entitlements to try and move entitlements. But if the reality is that the value of the advantages, the tax advantages that are there, will considerably outweigh the losses that the farmers will be hit with through the changes in the cap. And the final thing on that, and this is really crucial, is that convergence is going to considerably change things, because there was a time when a high value entitlement, say over 400 euros, was worth so much more if you were going to sell it than a low value entitlement. And people who had high value entitlements minded them very well. But as we move, basically with convergence, there's going to be very little difference between high value entitlements and average entitlements. And there won't be much difference between average entitlements and minimum entitlements by 2027. That's the purpose of convergence. And that will change that market completely. There are an awful lot of low-value entitlements that are not worth leasing in farmers' minds at the moment. They will increase in value, and it will reduce the power of those farmers with good land with high value entitlements, because you can lease the land separate to the entitlements, and you can get the, you pick up entitlements to buy or lease from that new flooded market by 2027. So I think that we have a couple of very difficult years, and people who are in leases need some guidance on how to evolve them. But the future for leasing of land and entitlement seems pretty clear to me. The party's over.
Aidan, you were going to come in there on the leases.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree with anything Pat has said. Like, but you're going to see a thing now that's going to give. There's going to be preferential tenants almost, because the farmer that Justin spoke about, yeah. Like if I was leasing my land to someone, I probably wouldn't lease to that farmer, because chances are I'm going to lose a significant portion of my BPS. Whereas you know, you could lease to someone else who maybe is a smaller operator, and you might be able to get back 100% or close enough to 100% of your entitlement. So there's that's going to cause issues. Maybe I'm wrong, Pat, but that's my.
Well, the difference is basically the CRIS, which is €44. It's up to the farmer himself whether he goes for the eco scheme or not. But remember, the eco scheme is not linked to the entitlement. You don't need the entitlement to access the eco scheme. So I think all landowners who are leasing out their entitlements legally will find it very hard to enforce payment of the eco scheme money, because the entitlement is not required, just the land.
What Aidan is saying is right, is in the context of you're a larger operator and it's going to get hit by capping. He's correct in that, whereas if you're a smaller operator, then capping's not an issue.
Capping, there is. But just to put that again in context, yes, initially, but by 2027, capping will only affect someone with over 165 hectares. So you're talking about only a few hundred people in that space, Justin, being realistic.
This is what really bugs me when I hear of the minister coming out and saying, well, 80% of farmers are going to win on this and only 20% of farmers are going to lose. That's fine unless you're one of those 20% of farmers, or unless you're one of those couple of hundred farmers that are genuine farmers, and a lot of them tillage farmers, actually, because they need the scale for the machinery and whatnot. Now, like, I know you're not defending it, but I just, there are a cohort of farmers out there that are going to be very, very badly damaged by this.
Well, you've got to remember, those large tillage farmers, until dairy expansion, were paying way more for land than anyone else could even think of paying. And in terms of the large tillage farmers who have potatoes or who have horticulture, until 2014, there was no payment whatsoever on land for potatoes or horticulture. And those farmers were still paying more on a per hectare basis than anyone else. So it matters far less to those large hort farm and potato growers than you might imagine, because until 6-7 years ago, they were operating. They were getting paid on their grain crops. But apart from that, the fields that they had any non-grain crops in, or non-protein crops in, they were getting no payment whatsoever. So they're well used to it, and they'll revert. It's the large-scale grain farmers and the platforming dairy farmers who are going to be hit by this.
Katrina, I'm conscious it's New Year's and we could end up running this podcast the whole way through 2022.
I was just going to say, we're gone down the entitlements rabbit hole.
You can see, there's no common view even within the journal, never mind among farmers. It's certainly going to be an interesting one to watch in 2022.
Absolutely, absolutely. Bahash, if I can, and we'll go briefly because we are very pressed for time, but in general, I suppose, the government under pressure from all angles. Number one, it's a coalition, which is always under pressure. Number two, COVID. You know, we've had tighter restrictions now at the very end of 2022, which everybody swore wasn't going to happen. The interplay between Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens, there's very much a green stamp. Justin mentioned it earlier, very much a green stamp on a lot of policies this year. How do you see it playing out in early 2022?
The tensions between the government parties have been more about small stuff than big stuff. The Greens are certainly, you can say, they've put their stamp on. But if you look at either a cap or you look at the climate action strategy, the 51% reduction, those are things which have been imposed on us by Brussels rather than things which have been decided at national level, and it's how they've been evolved. Charlie McConlogue would claim that getting a sectoral target of 22 to 30% for agriculture was a significant achievement in any government. The Ciarán Cough letter was, a breaking point for a lot of farmers in terms of the Greens' attitude to farming and farmers and their dismissal of its future and the commercial future of it. The idea that we can have a sort of an amateurish hobby farming, organic, labour intensive in the 21st century that will feed the volume of people that's required as something that is a huge difference of mentality between farmers and the Green Party. But one of the reasons that the government is functioning in relation to agriculture is because the opposition, really, Sinn Féin would be quite happy with the CAP outcome. McCarthy was very prominent up until the middle of the year, but he's been rather quiet in the agricultural matters. He's become involved in more general political matters. He's one of the leading lights in Sinn Féin now, who are the largest party in opinion polls and seem destined for government, but quiet on agricultural matters. And it is the likes of government backbencher Tim Lombard who put in the intervention around biogenic methane into the Climate Action Plan bill back in June. The likes of Richard O'Donoghue, who drove a truck into the Dáil, not into the wall of it, but into the car park. The likes of Carol Nolan, who's brought forward legislation around inspections. And the usual suspects in Matty McGrath, the Healy Rays, these people, Michael Fitzmaurice in particular, is a consistent advocate for farming in rural Ireland, who are providing the opposition to government. But I don't think Charlie McConlogue, Pippa Hackett and Martin Hayden are feeling a lot of heat from the opposition political parties. The other political parties apart from Sinn Féin, such as Labour, the Social Democrats, People Before Profit, are urban based and rarely really on the pitch when it comes to farming matters. So I think the heat on the government is coming outside of agriculture.
Guys, we leave it there. Thanks, my thanks to Amy McKeever, Aidan Brennan, Justin McCarthy, Pat O'Toole and Darren Carty. And from everybody in the Farmers Journal, we wish you a very happy new year and a very happy and safe time over the coming months. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.